This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Messer is off this week. A big week in politics, from midterm primaries here to escalating tensions between the U.S. and China. On Tuesday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi became the highest-ranking American official to visit Taiwan in 25 years. We're going to have more on that in just a moment. Also ahead on the program, stories from a special double issue of Bloomberg Business Week that document the war on women playing out across the nation. It's one that's reached new heights with the Supreme Court's reversal of Roe v. Wade earlier this year. First up, though, we spotlight the woman who made headlines all week, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Bloomberg's Kriti Gupta and I spoke with Bloomberg senior government reporter Ian Marlowe about her East Asian trip and why it put Beijing on edge.
She's a particularly strong China hawk who, has been defying China on a lot of these things, on human rights, on trade issues, on other things for most of her career. I mean, if you look back to just after the Tiananmen Square crackdown in 1989, her and a couple of other senators unfurled a little banner in Tiananmen Square, commemorating those who died, something, that seems unthinkable now, but shows you just how far she's willing to go in terms of, sticking up for, her values and other things at the risk of, at that point, personal safety, but also on this trip, geopolitical ramifications. I mean, she was willing to go through with this. We can talk about whether she was ever going to realistically be able to back down after the trip was announced. But, she was willing to go through with this, even though there were obviously huge consequences. And I think, a visit to Taiwan at any given point in time for China is very sensitive. They protest, regularly when these types of delegations go. But it's just the seniorness of her going is just a little bit too much for China to bear right now, especially given the sensitive domestic dynamics in China.
Right. Well, I think what's so interesting about the timing here is it's happening at the same time as you have two massive bills, I believe, passed through Congress. You have the $52 billion CHIPS Act over 5 years. And then on top of that, you have this order from the Commerce Department, I believe, for a lot of these names like Intel and NVIDIA to actually not, that disincentivizes them to increase their fab production over in Taiwan and China.
Yeah, it's not just about human rights. It's not just about ideology. It's about, strategic economic competition between the two. And she's been part of a very, generally bipartisan push to sort of decouple from China and to push the U.S. sort of manufacturing industry, especially in high tech, towards a more competitive edge with China, after a few decades where China really has benefited from, relatively stable and friendly international economic order.
if this really was a goal of the administration, why not put even more money towards it?
You know, like with any manufacturing, countries want to bring it home. They want to bring it close to, you know, to their other industrial base. But America is not the only place that is, you know, putting these types of bills in place, dedicating billions of dollars to, you know, funding those types of companies. And I think the brute reality here is that this technology, this manufacturing capacity is not in America right now, and it won't be for many years to come. And that's both structural, and it's also a matter of policy, with America sort of being late to this compared to, you know, to whether it's places like Taiwan or South Korea or China itself.
That was Bloomberg senior government reporter Ian Marlowe. We turn now to our next guest, my Bloomberg Quick Take colleague, Scarlett Fu. She worked in Hong Kong for 8 years and has a personal connection to Taiwan.
I used to visit Taiwan regularly. I would go every other summer because my grandparents lived there. My parents grew up in Taiwan. They were born in China, but they fled to Taiwan with the nationalist government, grew up in Taiwan, and we would go back and visit family regularly. So I really was able to see Taiwan evolve and develop from a society that lived under martial law to a society that was holding free elections.
So what's so important about it? Why do we care about this particular location?
In real estate, it's location, location, location.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the case here because Taiwan is about 100 miles off of China's southeastern coast. If you were to look at it on a map, it is the biggest landmass between Japan and the Philippines. So it's in this crucial position. And so the U.S. and every other country in the Asia-Pacific region sees Taiwan as crucial to containing China and its military ambitions and economic ambitions. That's just strategically. Then you've got, of course, the economics. The world is completely dependent on Taiwan's semiconductors. The island is responsible for about 92% of the world's most advanced chips. These are the chips that power your smartphone, your car, the AI in your smartphone, the AI in your car. Yeah. So it makes the world go round right now.
Talk to us a little bit about China's relationship with Taiwan and where it stands right now.
It's really, really complicated is the short answer. It's really actually quite convoluted as well, because if you go back to recent history, Japan had to give up Taiwan to China after losing World War II. But there was a civil war in China, so the nationalist government that was in China was defeated by the Communist Party. They fled the mainland and set up shop in Taiwan. They were supported by the U.S. government, which recognized the Nationalist Party as the rightful government, but temporarily displaced government of China. And then everything switched when the U.S. decided to change sides and recognize the communist government in Beijing instead. In doing so, it recognized that Beijing is the seat of government for China. There's only one China, and it is the government in Beijing. China has a one-China policy. The U.S. agrees with that. Taiwan is part of China. The U.S. agrees with that. But at the same time, it hasn't really clarified what it would do if China were to take Taiwan. Taking Taiwan by force, taking Taiwan by welcoming it back, not clear. There's a lot of intentional ambiguity when it comes to Taiwan and where it fits in with the one-China policy when it comes to how the U.S. is going to act on anything.
Our thanks to Quick Take Scarlett Fu for her insight with tensions between the world's preeminent superpowers on the rise once again. Coming up next, Pelosi's visit to Taiwan is just one source of stress for China. Another is the multi-billion-dollar banking scandal embroiling the country's rural lending market. We'll explain when we come back. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Grassroots boycotts, an epic banking scandal, and overleveraged housing developers are stoking concerns that China may be on the verge of a Lehman Brothers moment. In a story you'll find in the finance section of the magazine this week, bankers at five local lenders are accused of stealing billions of dollars from depositors. Businessweek markets and finance editor Pat Regnier is here to explain the crisis in confidence and the dynamics of China's rural lending system.
It's actually very similar to, I think, things we might know of here, where you have these kind of networks of local banks that are there to kind of, you know, plow money into the countryside and businesses that have kind of historically not had enough capital. Editing this story, I was really reminded of kind of analogs to the savings and loan business here in the United States.
Interesting.
A long time ago. Very, very similar kind of situation in a lot of ways. And what some of these rural lenders were doing was they were offering people higher rates to attract deposits, and some, you know, alleged bad actors got involved in this. There was a company that had that was a major shareholder in five of these rural lenders. There was essentially a scam, and then that created really a mass movement of depositors demanding their money back.
Pat, talk to us about the trust factor here, because if you need to make a lending system work, at the core of it is you need that trust factor. What is at stake here when it comes to whether or not this is a system that can get recovered?
Yeah, I mean, I think like this is actually a broader issue in China generally. You know, this is one of a couple stories that we've been monitoring. We've also been monitoring this boycott on mortgages. Now, this is a different situation, but it involves developers who've built houses that they're not delivering. So you've had a lot of consumers who've in China who've really gotten a push for, you know, give us your money and we will give you a higher rate. Buy this apartment and you'll have a, you know, we'll deliver this apartment. And they're finding that like these promises are not being made good on. The difference in China and here is that then China also has a very powerful state that also has, you know, large ownership shares in all of the big state banks and can kind of come in and exert some control. But we're just seeing this control fray. And so we're seeing, you know, protests on the street and grassroots movements to kind of, you know, resist these things when they come along and really hurt ordinary Chinese consumers and households.
Do those ordinary Chinese consumers and households you're referring to, do they have any power when they go to the streets?
Well, I mean, it looks like they exerted some recently. You know, there was a very large protest in Henan province. And, you know, they were met with, you know, there were kind of violent clashes with security forces. I understand a lot of them were sort of plain clothes. It looked pretty bad. And now we're kind of seeing that here are the authorities. They're coming in, they're saying, you know, we're going to step in and we're going to make depositors whole and we're going to crack down on this rural lending system that we had earlier kind of loosened up on in order to make capital more available. And this is that kind of seesawing that, you know, from here in New York, as I edit these stories and I see them, that you really see out of China is this, there's both this kind of tight control and then a kind of a freewheeling consumer finance sector. And authorities are always kind of trying to find like the balancing point for this. And when it doesn't work, things happen on the streets.
That consumer financing sector is so crucial here because, I mean, didn't China have, and correct me if I'm wrong, Pat, but didn't China have in 2015 this massive kind of retail trading boom that it never quite recovered from? I want to say a lot of Chinese stocks are owned by the Chinese consumers. So to see it once again become a consumer lending story, I think is pretty interesting when it comes to how developed Chinese markets are actually getting.
Yeah, and you know, and we've also seen all these issues with like wealth management products that have been heavily sold and then, you know, maybe turned out to be riskier than people thought. And then, you know, you've seen China kind of trying to decide what it wants to do with these companies, that these big tech companies that have IPO'd and, you know, suddenly start to look like both, you know, separate power centers as large companies can be, but also maybe are taking on new financial risks that the regulators are trying to get their hands around. I mean, at one point, you know, there was an online lender through a phone app that, you know, I think was like the largest money market fund in the world. So you have this really kind of protean dynamic consumer sector, sometimes with a lot of envelopes being pushed, combined with a state that both, you know, really like wants to encourage investment, but also, you know, has its eye on, you know, social control and, you know, and then you see things kind of, you know, happen in terms of protests.
Well, Pat, speaking of social control, the story that you edited in the current issue, or the upcoming issue, I should say, of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, it ends with COVID zero. So we got to talk a little bit about what's going on with COVID zero, and not necessarily an update, but the weight that it's having on the economy right now, not just from the perspective of economic growth or lack thereof, but from the perspective of politically and what it means for China's future in terms of leadership.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be careful here because I'm not an expert on what's happening with COVID zero in China, but I do think that there is this kind of overall overlay of, you know, on top of all of this, you know, you have the fact that, you know, China has been very strict in its COVID controls, and that's creating a lot of social pressures and also, you know, constraints constraints on business. I mean, as one of the people we talked to, it's like all of this stuff is another risk getting baked into a big risk cake in China.
Right.
I mean, that big risk cake is the exact, I want to say, disincentive for a lot of Western investors to hop back into China. This story isn't exactly supportive of that, is it?
No, you know, it's tricky, though. I mean, it's hard to get a view from this in some ways from outside. You know, we've seen, you know, all of these problems with Evergrande unfolding last year. And you look at it and you think like, well, is this China's Lehman moment? And then things seem to kind of move a little bit slowly after things start to look bad. And then somehow these stories kind of keep coming back. So you sort of wonder, is this going to be, you know, going to go very slowly and then all of a sudden?
That was Pat Regnier, Business Week's Markets and Finance Editor, with a story from the magazine. You can find it online on the terminal and on newsstands now. Our thanks to Bloomberg's Kriti Gupta for joining us there as well. Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, we shift our focus back to domestic challenges in the world of finance, specifically in venture capital. Amy Noyakis, the CEO of the venture firm Anthemis, joins us on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Bloomberg News reported back in June that venture capital funding for the second quarter hit its lowest level since 2020. To help us make sense of the tough conditions and get insight into where women entrepreneurs are focusing their efforts, Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld and I spoke with Amy Noyakis, who's the co-founder and co-CIO at the venture capital firm Anthemis. We've talked to her before about venture capital, of course, and also about supporting women in venture capital. Amy, it's good to have you with us. How are you?
I'm good. I'm tired. It's been a very crazy, busy summer.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think it's been an interesting time for venture capital. You know, we've heard a lot about this sort of idea that it might be a silent crash happening in VC, or that we're at the beginning of the end of VC as the markets have dried up. But, you know, I'm telling you, from my perspective, I'm not seeing it. I mean, the current market environment has really put capital allocation decisions to the test. And I think people have made some big mistakes in the last couple of years. But the industry-wide correction that we're seeing this year isn't a surprise to any of us that have been doing this for decades, nor is it affecting all companies or all investors in the same way. I think it's just simply a needed correction, right? For the last 10 plus years, we've seen unprecedented amounts of capital shifting into venture capital, particularly in the tech sector, inspiring entrepreneurs and would-be founders to build new digital companies that are challenging the old guard and most importantly, are make a lot of sense. But in the majority of these cases, the markets and the employees and the consumers of these companies have reaped a ton of benefits through this evolution. However, there are lots of founders and investors alike who have attempted to build companies that aren't solving real problems. They're not focusing on business fundamentals, and they're letting hubris get the best of them, right? While the global funding has slowed, there are still plenty of great companies growing, expanding, and building, and there are still plenty of companies out there. And so I'm kind of feeling like the bigger issue is how many of these people that have kind of jumped into the game in the last inning are really throwing things off, right? Like VC is hard, and it's supposed to be. It's why the returns are so high. There's huge upside for investors that are finding and backing great companies. But the problem is, I think over the last couple of years, it's looked too easy. And that's attracted a lot of folks who, frankly, don't belong in the game. And now that it's gotten a little harder again, you've got to look a little harder for the good ideas. You've got to be smarter about the way you value these companies. It's the dumb money that's disappeared, and it's taken a lot of promising companies with it.
Give us some good ideas. Where are there still opportunities?
Well, I listen, on the investor side, I think there's a ton of opportunity in the early stage. It's still very much a sweet spot. A lot of the market contraction that we've seen has been in the later stage. I'm personally biased because we're at Anthemis big fans of the early stage strategy. But I think that if you're a quality early stage investor and you're in it for the long haul, you'll navigate this correction incredibly well. Valuations are getting haircuts that they deserve. Deal flow and competition for capital is sort of slowing a bit. And investors at the early stage, I think, are well positioned. Got to focus on the fundamentals. You've got to stay away from the fluff, the hubris. A great company is a great company, and there's always space for great companies. I'd say for the companies and the founders, they should probably take the advice that they should have heeded years ago. Not all capital is the same. Pay attention to who's backing your company, and don't get swindled by a heady valuation that you know you can't back up.
I mean, we've seen so many examples of that. I don't want to say they were, you know, swindled, but we've seen a lot of down rounds in the past few months, Amy.
Yeah, and listen, that's not surprising, right? I mean, the role and the purpose of a good venture capital investor hasn't changed. It is our job and should be our job to deploy capital responsibly and help grow portfolio companies. That doesn't mean that there's a one-size-fits-all approach to how we do that. And I think the biggest issue for me is that so many of these players have jumped in, eyes closed, with little to no experience in how to build and support a quality company. And these are the folks that have caused a lot of the pain in the market. You know, I think some of this strategy is driven by hubris, and I don't think it's appropriate to write the entire sector off just because a large number of folks decided to jump into the deep end naked before checking if there was water in the pool, right?
Hey, I want to get an update on the Female Innovators Lab that you recently launched. And because when we talk about venture capital, especially women in venture capital, we're talking like single-digit percentage of venture capital goes to women each year.
Yeah, it's still, you know, it's still an area that we spend a lot of our time on at Anthemis, and I think a big part of that is because it was how we were founded, right? You know, I'm a woman founder of a company, and not only am I an investor, but I'm somebody who started a company from scratch and watched how hard it was and difficult it was to raise capital to grow my company, and there weren't a lot of supporters around. So when we looked across the entirety of the fintech sector, we wanted to make sure that we were playing a very solid role in sort of putting our money where our mouth is. And so we've been backing women founders in Europe and the U.S. for a couple of years now, specifically in what we call the earliest venture studio stage. Money and ideas coming together at the very beginning and helping these women build their company. And I think it's a really great opportunity not only to see some fantastic businesses and help women, you know, get a leg up and grow, but also, you know, as we've sort of found, it's making a huge difference.
That was Amy Noyakis, co-founder and co-CIO at the venture capital firm Anthemis. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Up next, we explore the latest salvos in America's war on women in the aftermath of Roe v. Wade's reversal. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
The latest issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine is a special double issue with the entire feature section dedicated to the struggles facing women in America today. And the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade back in June may have been the breaking point. Katie Greifeld and I are here with Business Week economics editor Christina Lindblad and Business Week features editor Danielle Sachs to explore this hard-hitting and at times heartbreaking series of stories and personal accounts that have emerged since the ruling. Christina, I want to start with you and talk a little bit about this double issue, this section, and how it all came together. When did you start thinking about it?
It started as a conversation right after the leak of the memo, the Supreme Court memo. It started actually with some members of our art department who are young mothers and an editor-in-chief. And it was, you know, this idea. Actually, the language we used at the beginning was, it feels like there's a war on women going on in America. And it grew out of there. We sort of began to take stock, like not just of, you know, the Supreme Court decision, but formula shortages, the past 2 years of, working from home, juggling, school closures, and just sort of how women feel burnt out. And then this just really, the Supreme Court decision just really felt like, it just almost is too much to take.
I can just add, Christina, it also just felt like overturning Roe was just like something that just felt unimaginable and sort of the final straw. And the leak was the first tip off to the disbelief. And then once it happened, we were like, not only do we have to do this issue, but we have to do this issue very quickly because the rage has just been unleashed.
And so what I really like about this issue is how many different angles you attack it from. And we're going to get into a few here. But Christina, let's start with sort of the economic impact. What this means for women and all the advancements that women have made so far over the past decades.
I think that people maybe weren't aware of actually how much research has been done on what abortion access means to women's own personal financial well-being and how writ large what that means for the economy. People have done, research looking at this and found that, for educational attainment, like huge factor and earnings and the types of careers that women end up in, and you multiply that sometimes 2, 3, 4 times for minorities. It actually, there were 154 economists and researchers compiled this huge amicus brief for the court, summarizing all of these decades worth of research. But as we know, in the end, the majority opinion, if you read it, is framed very narrowly on constitutional grounds and did not really address any of that.
One thing that I noticed in the wake of the leaked opinion back in May, and then in the actual overturning of Roe v. Wade, was the way that a lot of people started talking about abortion and reproductive medical care differently. There was this move to really be public with experiences that many women and men had gone through. And I'm wondering if you could tell us about what I think is one of the most powerful features in the magazine, which features 10 women sharing their stories about how an abortion changed their life.
Christina just talked about the studies and the research that we have telling this economic story, but we really wanted to humanize that and bring that to a personal level, and really find and have women share their own stories of how not only an abortion changed their life personally, but their ability to earn a living or their financial trajectory or their ability to just live out their hopes and dreams. And we really wanted to talk to a cross-section of women. We didn't just want to talk to, a bunch of CEOs. We wanted to hear from women CEOs. We wanted to hear from working-class women. We wanted to hear from Black women, immigrant women, really a cross-section. And there were certainly, we had 2 women who actually, one is 76 and one is 80, so they obviously had their abortions pre-Roe. So not only did they share the kind of harrowing stories of what it was like to, get a phone number, call from a payphone, have someone pick you up in a car to get an abortion, unsure if you will ever make it home, but then be able to 55 years later tell the story of how that enabled them to have children, 15 years after that, and not only create financial stability for themselves, but for the next generation. We spoke to a woman who grew up Mormon in Utah and talked about hitting her professional ceiling at the age of 22 because being a white Mormon woman who's pregnant, like that's it for your professional life. And so she was able to find a neighbor who helped give her the money to get an abortion, and she ended up leaving Utah. And now she's not only carved out an amazing career for herself, she's married, and her husband's a stay-at-home father. We definitely heard from this cross-section of women that in the brown and Black communities, that it's often taboo to talk about an abortion, and that sort of plays into a lot of the anti-abortion rhetoric and campaigns that have gone on over the years, how, the Dobbs ruling, really, these women felt liberated, like we have to get rid of the shame and we have to talk about and share these stories that may be uncomfortable. We even had a state senator open up to us and talk about as something she's carried with her for decades. And since she's come out about it, she's discovered two other women in her family wow. who also had abortions. This has unleashed not only rage among women, but just sort of like bringing these critical conversations to the forefront.
You know, when reading this issue, the features, the articles in the issue, one theme kept coming up was how deeply personal this is, not just for the people featured, but for the way that we talk about reproductive rights here in the U.S. And Christina, that's no exception for your own story. And you got deeply personal
yeah.
in your essay here.
Yes, I talked about an abortion I had at 26 for the same reasons that Danielle was talking about, this other person we interviewed. I wasn't ready. I had an idea of what I wanted my career trajectory to be. I was in the early parts of that. I had just gotten a master's degree, and just motherhood wasn't part of that plan at that early. I now have two children. It would be 10 years before I would go on to have my first child. So, yeah, I do think it's really important that we normalize talking about this, that we get rid of this stigma, because we have to convince the world that that allowing women to plan the size and the timing of their families is their right.
Christina, if I could just add, it's not only impacting women, as Tim, I think you mentioned earlier, like this impacts men. And I think some of that research, Christina, that you pointed to earlier talks about how, you know, the right to choose does have a ripple effect on men, because obviously there are men, the men are the other half of this equation. And when you're talking about whether it's like teen pregnancies or pregnancies in your 20s, I mean, that changes the trajectory of, or can change the trajectory of a guy's life too.
Well, Danielle, pushing forward, one of the stories that you edited was specifically about digital privacy and this new abortion landscape that we're living in now. I mean, when you think about what people are even searching, what apps they might have on their phone, there's concern about sort of those privacy protections that are in place.
One of, you know, I think there's so many conversations happening coming out of this moment. And one of the ones that I think very quickly surfaced, specifically from the tech community and from abortion rights activists, is that women, trans women, non-binary, we're now living under this kind of new surveillance state. Any move you make, any digital move you make, whether it's a period tracking app, your web searches, text messages, and now it's like, well, actually, investigators can get their hands on this data and potentially use this against me. And so there's this horrific case out of Mississippi where a woman several years ago not only went through the horrific experience of having to deliver a stillborn baby, but they went through her web searches and found that she at one point had searched for abortion pills. And so they brought murder charges against her. It's like, I think it took a year for them to eventually drop them. But that is sort of like the dystopia that we're talking about. You know, activists are definitely saying, like, even when it comes to text messages, women should be using encrypted services like a Signal or a WhatsApp.
Yeah.
You know, there's like location data that can be tracked about, you know, is she traveling to get an abortion out of state? Or, you know, was she searching for abortion pills online? The period tracking apps, there are millions and millions of women who use these. And the data can be shared, you know, with analytics firms who can hand
yeah.
that over to investigators.
A completely different world from when decades ago the ruling of Roe v. Wade came down. Many thanks to Businessweek editors Christina Lindblad and Danielle Sachs for sharing their stories and for shining a light on these important issues. We really just scratched the surface in this special double issue of Bloomberg Businessweek, available on newsstands now, online at bloomberg.com/businessweek, and of course, on the Bloomberg terminal. We have more stories in there, including the political angle. Democrats aren't forgiving Biden's slow response to the Roe reversal. And then also how it's getting harder to be a woman in the U.S. We're going to dive into that in just a few minutes. That does wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Tim Stenovic. Katie Greifeld is in this week for Carol Masser. Ahead in our next hour, we'll focus on a cover story about the deterioration of women's rights in America, and we'll take you to West Texas It's among the country's most dangerous places for pregnant women. This is Bloomberg.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including more on what it means to be a woman in modern times. From living in a post-Roe America to scrolling past the online haters. First up, though, a gripping essay from the magazine that serves as the cover story for this special double issue. Business Week columnist Claire Suddeth joins me and Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld to explain why the undoing of Roe v. Wade makes everything far more precarious for American women following 50 years of prosperity.
It's a combination of negligence and indifference, and then women's circumstances getting worse. You know, I think women have, as has everyone, you know, been coming out of this pandemic 2 years of maybe no childcare or unreliable childcare. You know, millions of women dropped out of the labor force in the depths of the pandemic. I think it's 1 million still have yet to return to work. And the most common reason given is that they can't find or afford childcare. We still don't have paid leave. We're the only wealthy country that doesn't give new moms time off work after they have a baby. We're in this situation where women have been struggling for so long, and then things have been getting, you know, immeasurably harder, largely because of COVID, but not entirely. Yet we still are not doing anything about it. You know, we periodically have bills before Congress about maybe we'll give parents 4 weeks of paid leave. You know, that having had a baby, that's not very much time at all. A baby isn't even legally able to be accepted by a licensed daycare facility at that young age. So many of these bills stall and go nowhere or just flat out fail. Then there's the formula shortage. There's all these other things that keep happening, you know, school shootings. And it just feels to women like this constant barrage of bad news, and they just can't get on top of it.
And so the cover of Bloomberg Business Week, I absolutely love what the cover looks like, and it has the breaking point in big text right there. And I'm curious, I mean, okay, if we're at the breaking point now, does anything change? Is there any sort of, I don't know, light in at the end of the tunnel that things will get better, or just are things as we look at them now just going to get harder from here?
I think in the short term, things are going to get harder. You know, maybe even in the long term, I don't know. It really just depends on what states and the federal government do going forward about all of this. But a lot of these sort of large scale chronic social issues, no one's really addressing them in a meaningful sort of way. I think people do want some good news. And I think the good news, this is a lot harder to measure, but as women are talking about this more amongst themselves, with men in their lives, and while that's sort of hard to measure or really, put your finger on,
Well, Claire,
the mood has shifted, at least.
You've seen a lot of sort of pieces of legislation stall at the federal level in Congress at various degrees of government. Does that sort of put the onus then on corporations, at least, you know, when we're talking about women in their corporate lives, to try to make things better? Like, could this be used sort of as a recruiting tool?
I think it has for a long time. I mean, you know, when you look at the statistic, I think it's like 23% of workers in the U.S. have access to paid parental leave. Almost all of those workers are white collar workers. And so if you are a company, if you're in tech, finance, you know, anything where you're competing for talent, there's a reason why companies in recent years have expanded their paid leave policies, is because it makes them more attractive. The issue is that there's not a trickle down effect. You know, we're still at that, you know, under a quarter of workers. The percentage of low wage workers who get any sort of leave at all is, I don't know what the updated number is, but as of last year, it was less than 10%. I think it was 9%. And so yes and no, I think is the answer to that, because I get the question is sort of like, who are you talking about when you ask that question?
Claire, you spent a good portion of time over the last few months dedicated to a feature that's in the current issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's all about part of West Texas that's become a very dangerous place to be pregnant and how it's getting even scarier there. Texas leads the U.S. in maternity ward closures. What did you find in your visit to West Texas?
Yeah, so I came to this story because I kept reading all of these like small local stories and local papers all over the country about hospitals closing their maternity wards. And I thought, what? How can you close a maternity ward? Doesn't every hospital need to be able to deliver babies? And I looked into it further, and Texas is sort of like the epitome of the problem. And within Texas, the epitome of the problem there is this town called Alpine, which is in West Texas, truly in the middle of nowhere. I mean, 3.5 hours, I think, from El Paso, 5 hours from San Antonio. And we're not talking driving on an expressway type of road. This is like a highway with no rest stops. And it's the only hospital within a 12,000 square mile area that delivers babies. And so many nurses burnt out and quit during the pandemic that it is, I think now is open about 5 days a week. But for the majority of the past year, it's been only able to deliver babies 3 days a week, which, if you know anything about having a kid, they don't arrive on schedule. You can't say, I'll just give birth on Tuesday, then I guess that's fine. You know, women do try to schedule inductions to try to work around that, but even that is like not working. And because the access to prenatal care is also incredibly low, with this being the only hospital, they have a lot of what are called preterm births, or babies born really early, and they need access to a NICU or neonatal intensive care unit, and Big Bend doesn't have one. And so they have to medevac these babies out to larger hospitals.
Wow. Read Claire's full essay in the magazine, available online and on newsstands now. Up next, internet misogynists are making it harder for women online, too. Luckily, there's Drew F. Wallow.
She's really kind of established this role for herself, almost this like folk hero type role, going after guys who are kind of awful on the internet.
The story of the TikTok vigilante we don't deserve, but desperately need. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, a story featured in the new issue of Business Week magazine, written by Alex Barinka, technology reporter for Bloomberg News, is all about how one of TikTok's biggest stars is roasting dudes for misogyny and racism. Alex Brink is technology reporter for Bloomberg. Also with us is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So Joel, it's so funny. We're talking about a person named Drew F. Wallow. And, you know, we think about the power that people have with these platforms. She has got 7.5 million followers on TikTok. So it's fewer than Justin Bieber, but she's got like as many as Jimmy Fallon.
Almost as much as Jimmy Fallon. Yeah. And yet, you know, not
big.
Maybe not a household name. And it just speaks to how well she owns TikTok. And it was also just totally caught our attention from the moment that Alex flagged this as an option, because Drew, in the aftermath of the Supreme Court decision that basically, you know, upended Roe versus Wade, we're thematically talking about that this in this week's issue, and this is a sort of a surprising silver lining to all of that, which is how laughter can actually become a weapon. Alex, tell us more about Drew's approach here.
Yeah, and you know, you say she's not a household name, but if you're on TikTok, she is absolutely a household name, for better or for some of these misogynistic type online trolls, for worse. Drew is a character who's really increased in popularity over the last year. We got to chat for this story. She is sharp, she is witty, but she also cares really deeply about women who she says she's protecting on the platform. If you see a Drew video in your feed on TikTok, you'll be scrolling and a video of a guy will typically pop up saying some pretty awful things. They're either racist, they're sexist, they're fat phobic. And then all of a sudden Drew's face will cut in, usually with her kind of trademark laughter, cackling at these men. And she basically kind of dismantles them. And she does it in a really interesting way. Drew is very smart and clever, and she makes some really like logical points and basically picks apart these guys with logic. But she also takes these tactics that online trolls are really known for: comedy, commenting on people's appearance, telling the guy he's already going bald, and kind of wraps the logic in this wrapper of these same tactics that online trolls like to use when they go after women on the platform. And I'll tell you, I've seen these guys take down videos or just like completely delete their accounts. They don't take it as well as maybe some of their victims do. So she's really kind of established this role for herself, almost this like folk hero type role, going after guys who are kind of awful on the internet.
Kind of awful.
No shortage of those guys.
I was going to say.
Is that editorializing too much?
The internet makes it very easy for people to say all sorts of things. It's also, I think, something social media platforms have really tried to address. Walk us through how maybe that's not enough.
Yeah, so the platforms are a little bit reactive, right? They might ban certain words or allow creators to mute words or block people. But these guys will kind of take tactics that that stay a step ahead, or trolls, to speak more generally. If they are banning things like quote, "I hate fat women," and folks notice that that language is getting banned or taken down for bullying by the platforms, they'll change tact and say things like, "I only love men who weigh less, women who weigh less than 120 pounds." So the platforms are, whether it's TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, they all have policies in place to kind of combat bullying. But look, frankly, these bad actors on the platform move a lot quicker and speak in different languages or use code that is very well recognized by people on the internet. But it's this little bit of a game of kind of whack-a-mole. What Drew's been able to do is basically keep up with the times and kind of, slide a knife through these guys online and keep up with what they're saying and how they're kind of skirting these rules. So there's some things out there. A lot of it depends on fans, followers, or people on the platforms to report things themselves. But, you know, if you can stay a step ahead, then maybe that hand-to-hand combat is a little bit more fierce in the moment.
It just feels like she may have, like, no shortage of options to pick from. And I'm curious, did you put that towards her? Like, how does she pick who she takes down?
Yeah, so initially she would kind of, I'm talking a year and a half ago when she started this this kind of path. She would look for guys and find them who are kind of saying awful things. These days, she wakes up to thousands and thousands of notifications across all platforms. She has those notifications turned off because there are so many of them. But a lot of times now, her fans, her followers will actually tag her in videos of people who are going after women or who are, slewing racist, misogynistic, or fatphobic comments on the platform. There's another camp. There's a lot of folks who like to attack her. So those are coming straight into her notifications as well. But, you know, it seems like there's a lot out there. I will say, she did tell me that it's getting a little bit tougher to find guys that she hasn't roasted before or subject matter she hasn't roasted before. So, you know, whether that's because she's doing her job too well as she sees it or if things are cracking down a little bit, who knows?
She should come over to Twitter.
A lot of these things are referrals.
Yeah, she should come over to Twitter. I see a lot of this stuff there. Can you talk a little bit about the business of somebody with 7.5 million followers on TikTok? Like, how does she make money?
Yeah, absolutely. So Drew wouldn't divulge exactly how much she makes, but she will say she's making a living off of it. There are a few venues for somebody like her to make money. The platforms do pay out a small amount if you're in something like TikTok's creator fund. But when I talk to creators across the platform outside of just Drew, they say that's basically coffee money or lunch money. Where they make a lot of their money is on brand sponsorships, brand partnerships, where they'll post sponsored posts with clothing or other products. Drew also has a podcast, so folks will start to venture outside of the platforms as well for opportunities for advertisers or sponsors to work with her.
That was Bloomberg technology reporter Alex Barranca, along with Businessweek editor Joel Weber and Bloomberg Markets reporter Kriti Gupta. And we salute the entire team from the magazine for their outstanding work on this issue. Still to come on Bloomberg Businessweek, a Silicon Valley veteran has a new playbook for both aspiring and established workplace leaders.
The manager's job is to help a group of people be able to achieve more together. So how do they do that?
Tech entrepreneur Julie Zhu explains that and more up next. This is Bloomberg.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Katie Greifeld and I have been in here chatting about what it's like to be a manager. And you know what? Spoiler alert. Neither of us are managers.
No, somehow I'm not in charge of a single person other than myself.
It's probably a good thing for both of us. I know it's a lot of work. It's really interesting because it's something that Julie Zhu writes about. She's the co-founder of the tech advisory firm Inspirit and also the author of The Making of a Manager, What to Do When Everyone Looks to You.
So I was 25 years old. I had just joined a scrappy startup 3 years prior. It was a little college social networking site at the time called Facebook.
Heard of it.
Luckily for me, you know, the startup grew and grew. And so within a couple years, we had added a lot more people. And since I was one of the early people there, one day my manager turned to me and said, you know, we have four new designers joining next week and I don't have time to meet with them. Why don't you be their manager? And at this point, you know, I had no training about how to lead, how to manage. But yet I found myself in this situation needing to ramp up new people and help our team grow. And this is a very common story in Silicon Valley or in any context where a small team starts to take on bigger and bigger goals. And that is how I found myself in that role. Without that preparation, I made every single mistake in the book about learning how it is to manage and lead people. And ultimately, some years later, I decided to write all that down and hopefully make it seem like I'm having a coffee chat with somebody else finding themselves in that situation.
And so, I mean, if you could go back in time and talk to younger Julie, newly in that situation, what would you say? What would be the main bullet point there?
The most important thing I would tell somebody in that situation, here is what the job of a manager is. Because here's the thing. We grow up, we watch movies, we have a sense of, like, what does the boss do, right? And we think about the boss as the person who makes decisions, the person who hires and fires people, the person who gets to tell everyone else, you know, what's right and how things go. And the reality is, in my experience, like, that's not really what great managers do. So the first thing I want someone to understand is, what exactly is the job of management? And very simply, I define it as the manager's job is to help a group of people be able to achieve more together. So how do they do that, right? How do they actually get a group of talented people to achieve more together? There are three main levers that a manager has. The first is people. You know, you need to bring in talented people who have the skills to be able to do what the group wants to do together. The second is process. So you have all of these great people. Okay, how should they work together? You know, how do they come up with new ideas? How do they resolve disagreements? Who should do what? You know, how does the work get divided? And finally, purpose, which is defining what does success look like for this group of people? How do we know what a good job is? How do we know what a great job is? How do we know what a mediocre job is? All that has to be shared in terms of all of the members on the team in order for this to team to go on and do great things.
I'm wondering about people who may not be managers yet and may not even aspire to be managers, and how, you know, we talk about this idea of managing up and the idea of working with your bosses in a way that is productive. What advice do you have for people in those situations?
The most important advice I have for somebody when they think about managing up is make sure you know these two things. Make sure that your manager knows what you aspire for, what your goals are in your career. Right? Do you want to get a promotion? Do you want to manage one day? Do you want to take on big projects? Or you know, are you very happy doing what you're doing? You know, what kind of projects are you excited to take on? What kind of challenges are meaningful? And what kind of things do you hate doing? Make sure your manager understands that, right? So ask yourself, does my manager understand what my aspirations are, what my strengths are, what my weaknesses are? And if not, go ahead and tell them, right? Tell them in a one-on-one, make sure they know. And the second question is, do I understand what success for my manager looks like in regards to what I can do to help them? Because if you don't feel like you know what your manager is aspiring for in regards to the team that you're a part of or what success for you looks like, you know, you're going to be basically talking past each other. So both of these things need to be true. And if they're not clear, that's what, you know, time with the manager in one-on-one setting is for, right? Make sure they understand your goals. Make sure you understand their goals.
That's Julie Zhu. She's co-founder at Inspirit, and her new book is called The Making of a Manager, What to Do When Everyone Looks to You. It's out now. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, an insider's take on the New York real estate market.
Can you
imagine trying to rent a studio for $4,000 a month? And most of these guys don't realize just how fast the product's moving. I would venture to guess right now, product is on the market for less than 3 days.
Plus, the CEO of Sentient Jet tells us why the business of private aviation is taking off. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
We're wrapping up this weekend's program with a pair of guests whose respective businesses revolve around two big-ticket items, Manhattan apartments and private jets. We'll start with real estate. And despite rising interest rates and declining home sales nationally, prices here in the Big Apple are still soaring. For more insight into the key trends to watch in New York City's housing scene, Carol Masser and I spoke with Frances Katzen. She's founder of the Katzen team at the residential brokerage firm Douglas Elliman.
There's such a disconnect between the commercial and the residential. The residential has seemed to actually outperform expectation all the time, even amongst a 9.1% inflation, even amongst interest rate hikes. We're seeing such an interesting pattern. You know, this year alone, condo median sales prices are up 14.1% against last year, which was the run-up, inverted commas. So there seems to be this really niche demand for people wanting to diversify from their portfolio back into real estate because there's been a capitulation over the past couple of months.
So, Frances, are they just buying real estate as an investment and not living in it?
So what's happened is that you've got two types of buyers. You've got people who want to actually diversify with 1031 money, buying into these homes and actually getting an absolute sugar high on their rentals. The rental market is up 40% year over year with less than 2% vacancy rate, with an average trading price for a studio of $4,000, which means that it's on a sugar high like no one's seen, which is allowing people to get a pro forma into effect that gives them a good rent roll. The end user is also taking advantage because although the rates have gone up, there's still this potential value because when there's uncertainty, there's negotiability.
What about when it comes to foreign buyers here?
What we saw was a very big change during COVID because there were some countries that were not going to be compliant with the FDA COVID requirements coming back into the U.S., such as China and Russia. So what we had was very specific buyers coming in. Now what we're seeing since the floodgates, if you will, have opened up, we've got a nice return of cash from overseas. A lot of people are coming into the luxury sector. That's luxury meaning over 4 million. This past week, we saw 21 contracts signed, which is 8 contracts up above the week prior. So we're seeing a lot of people wanting to come back and park their cash in New York.
When we start seeing prices like this, to me, it says it's getting a little bit hot. And at some point, this has got to cool.
Well, the sales market will adjust. And I think we're seeing that now. I think right now with the GDP at a negative 0.9%, some would say that we are in a recession. Some would say we're not. The market has cooled on its price per square foot performance, but the velocity has changed by simple virtue. There's not a lot of inventory right now because people don't want to sell down on their assets. So there's this pent-up demand for the remaining prospects who want to get in and get out of paying sugar high rental and get back into owning equity.
Where are you seeing any signs of slowdown right now? Because you have the entire spectrum when it comes to listings. Are you seeing any part of it slow down?
That's such a great question because you are seeing such a breakdown on segments. The entry market is the most impacted because they need the most compelling interest rate in order to buy in. With not a lot of wage growth, it's very tough to make, when you've got such high rental markets and people wanting to get out of being extorted on that, they want to own equity, but it's really tough. If the rates are going up, it squashes that segment because they have the least to spend and the most to lose. On the luxury side, they're not so dependent, neither is foreign money, on necessarily an interest rate. So you're finding that these particular customers are ready to play and are coming in to get a deal. And there's a conversation to be had between the extreme of what we want to achieve on the sale price and where the buyers feel inherent value is.
Help describe the rental market right now, because if you're a renter, if you're just moving to New York, you're in a tough spot right now.
Very. I mean, can you imagine trying to rent a studio for $4,000 a month and you have to be able to show 45 times the asking rent in their account?
It's brutal.
That's insane. And most of these guys don't realize just how fast the product's moving. It's not like you walk in and take a week and a half to think about it. Product is getting snapped up within hours. There's a stat right now on Jonathan Miller on the Miller Samuels report that shows that product on the market for less than 9 days. I would venture to guess right now, product is on the market for less than 3 days on average.
Wow.
It's that fast.
That was Francis Katzen, founder of the Katzen team at Douglas Elliman. So we know real estate prices are on the ascent. And you know what else is sky high? Interest in private jets. Aviation consulting firm Argus International reported back in June that private air traffic is 15% higher than it was 2 years ago. One of the beneficiaries is Andrew Collins. He's president and CEO of Sentient Jet.
We saw the addressable market expand per se, right? A lot of hidden people, hidden customers that, you know, really took a pandemic to bring them out. They might have been a little fiscally conservative or they might have thought about the sustainability issue. But at the end of the day, they came out. And products like ours, we invented the jet card. So you pre-buy 25 hours at a time. When you utilize a service like that, you tend to get used to it. And so I don't think all the new entrants that came in and the expanded, you know, amount of and the velocity by which, you know, the volume came, I don't know that that will remain exactly as it stands. But a good portion of it is we're very busy this summer. Despite, you know, raising rates and fuel surcharges and everything else, there is a voracious appetite for flying and traveling right now.
Are you back to pre-pandemic levels?
We are well past pre-pandemic levels.
Really?
Yeah.
And is most of it leisure or is it a combination of leisure and,
business? Little tricky because it used to be, I could tell you it was 60% corporate and it was 40% leisure, et cetera. Now it's very much hard to track because it's a lot of individuals, a lot of individual flying. They might be just expensing it. You have no idea in some cases. You'd have to look at kind of time of day and
what
where
do you
they're
mean
traveling.
You don't know? I mean, a corporate credit card goes through, right? Doesn't it?
Like, because when you, with our card, you actually deposit money and then we just debit it down. So we'll never really know if you're using it for business or not, unless you did set it up as a business account.
Okay. Right.
But
because somebody pays for it, right?
Somebody does pay for it. Yeah. And it's and a lot of times it's a primary customer and it's in their name. At the end of the day, though, you can tell, like you can tell certain routes and you can see things come back. Teterboro's come back a lot. Westchester's come back.
Right.
You know, Van Nuys has come back. So there's a lot of business travel out there that's almost sneaky, but it's definitely happening.
Do you anticipate a reversion to the mean as we do ease out of the pandemic and you get back to pre-pandemic levels, which were significantly lower than they are now? People become more comfortable on commercial travel?
Well, I think that commercial's got a long way to go. And that's, you know, without disrespect to my commercial brethren. But there's a lot of people that left the airline industry and they're not coming back, or pilots and crews retired. So there's a lot of challenges there. Over in Europe, it's even worse. So right now, you're seeing private jets, 15% year-over-year growth, due to the fact that it's just very difficult to travel throughout Europe. And I don't know that I see a lot of return yet. It just doesn't feel like that. It feels like in the fall and in the winter, especially this peak period, we're gearing up for a very big peak period during the winter.
Do you have all the workers that you need or that you want?
You have to be very aggressive.
Yeah.
So we've done a lot of aggressive work. We've done a lot of recruiting. We've hired a lot of recruiting people.
Aggressive means you're paying them more.
We're paying them more and we're talking to a lot more people. You know, it takes a lot more to fill one slot. So we're doing a lot. We're also doing
things. But not everybody can be a pilot.
No, not everybody can be a pilot. There's a lot of work that goes around being a pilot. But to get crews, for instance, you have to pay more.
Hey, Andrew, I want to touch on the sustainability efforts.
Sure.
You mentioned people who have been previously concerned about the environmental impact of perhaps traveling private might not have the same concerns now. It does emit a lot of CO2. I mean, we're talking tons and tons per single plane per hour, literal tons. What are you doing to offset that and to kind of make customers feel better about their environmental impact?
So you have a lot of different choices. You can do nothing and people will still pay and come on and fly. You can do a simple carbon offset, or, you know, a lot of people will offer access to a carbon offset service or something like that. We actually don't charge our customers and we do 300% offsetting. So we invest millions of dollars in the background to do emissions offsetting. So we go a little bit further. We go into the water vapors, the aerosols, the nitrous oxides, the things that actually make the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that we probably are doing one of the largest sustainability efforts in private aviation. And so we do it with a partner, but it's not an additional cost to our customer, and every flight is offset 300%. So in the first half of the year, we probably did the equivalent, if I was to compare it to things, it's the equivalent of planting 5 million trees or providing energy to your average, you know, town in America for a full year. It's a lot, and we're just getting used to it, and we're just learning it, and we're just experimenting with things, but right. we're trying to push our industry to do a lot more.
I agree. Push, push, push away. I love carbon offsetting. What about carbon negative efforts, where we're actually reducing the carbon in the atmosphere, which many would argue that that's what we need to do to save this planet?
You've got to look at a lot of things. You've got to look at sustainable aviation fuel. I think you've got to look at a lot of ways to, you know, one of the offshoots of the pandemic that's great is that it's virtual, so you're not doing a lot around the office as much and things like that. So we're looking at a lot of different ways to handle sustainability. I would tell you, though, the biggest push that can happen is in electric and what they're calling eVTOLs. And you know, as a company, we have 200 eVTOLs on order for
you
both
do.
You know, when Europe and North America.
When do you get those?
I hope, knock on wood, in 4 to 5 years.
Wow.
That was Andrew Collins. He's president and CEO of SentiaJet. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News and check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal. You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available on Bloomberg.com/QT, and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone. This is Bloomberg.